called in to say that all six of the space industry corporate chiefs were online for the emergency teleconference, except for Nobuhiko Yamagata. His chief legal counsel would participate in the conference in his place. The window wall broke up into six separate images, four men and two women, representing six of the seven major corporations that dominated space industries. Each of them was on Earth. Of the big seven, only Dan was off-planet. Dan touched one more key, and two smaller images appeared in the lower right corner of the window wall. A view of the landing pad outside, and an empty corridor deep below the office levels of Alphonsus City. Chewing Tamara out with one hand, Dan adjusted the phone camera on his desk so that it showed only a head-and-shoulders view of himself. If Jane wants to join the conversation, I'll swivel it around, he thought. Then he grinned crookedly at the six electronic images. I suppose you're all wondering why I asked you here today. It took 2.5 seconds for Dan's feeble little joke to reach them and their response to get back to the moon. They all tried to talk at once. In the sudden torrent of angry, frightened, urgent voices, Dan made out the clear fact that all of them were under pressure from the GEC to turn over control of all space industrial operations to the Council. "That means Malik," Dan said, loud enough to cut through their babble and silence them. "Malik wants to take over all our companies. He's always wanted to be the commissar of all space operations." Jane stirred slightly in her chair but said nothing. "I understand," said the Yamagata lawyer, a sallow-faced Japanese with narrow, suspicious eyes, "that your assets are being confiscated entirely at this very moment." "That's right," Dan said. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw a spacecraft settling down on the landing pad outside. It bore the sky-blue markings of the Global Economic Council. "What can we do to help?" asked the Argentinian president of Astrofabrica Corporación. "Not a hell of a lot, Jorge," Dan admitted. "But there's something even more important that you must be made aware of." Six faces stared at him, silent, waiting. The spacecraft sat on the landing pad while an access tunnel snaked toward it. Jane watched him too, her face as close to expressionless as she could make it. Dan began to explain to them about the greenhouse cliff. Only one of them had heard of it, the woman who headed Eurospace AG. "The head of my research staff is working with your chief scientist, I believe, to determine whether this phenomenon is real or not," she said.
"It's real, Hilda," Dan replied. "Malik knows it. He's using it as an excuse to take over all space industries. In the next 10 years, we either convert the whole spinning Earth away from fossil fuels, or we see the ice caps melt and sea levels go up 10 meters or more."
He waited the 2.5 seconds for their reaction. Then,
"In 10 years? That's not possible. I've never heard of such a thing. No one informed me. How can that be?"
"Your scientists can give you the details," Dan said, flicking the image in the corner of his window wall to show the corridor between the landing pad and the main plaza. Sure enough, Kate Williams was leading a dozen grim-faced men and women, all of them dressed in dark gray slacks and jackets bearing the GEC emblem. Quickly, Dan reviewed his discussion, argument, with Malik at Tet Yoroa, and emphasized Malik's decision to take over all the Big Seven space industrial corporations in the name of necessity due to the impending global disaster.
"He can't force us."
"Yes, he can if he has the council behind him.
I never trusted those politicians. We'll lose everything. What difference does that make if the world is drowned in 10 years?
Dan quieted them down, all the while watching Kate and her band of GEC enforcers making their way toward his office, and Jane sitting almost within his reach, silent, watching, waiting. "Now listen," Dan told the six of them. "Hilda is right. What difference does anything make if half the world's going to go underwater? We've all got to work together with the GEC to do whatever we can to avert this catastrophe." Jane looked surprised. He grinned at her.
"Work with the GEC? Let them take over our corporations? Allow them to steal what we've earned over all these years?"
"No," Dan said firmly. "We can work with the GEC and hold on to our companies. At least you can." Kate and her gang were at the door to his outer office. Tamara was getting up from her desk, ever so slowly,
to manually open the door for them. Jane was looking from Dan to the picture in the window wall's corner and back to Dan again. "We're facing a situation that's like a major war. The biggest double-damned war anybody's ever faced. We've got to stop thinking of our profits and start working with everything we've got to win. It's victory or death. There's no middle ground." "What you've got to do," he was saying quickly, knowing that he was running out of time, "is to make a voluntary statement, announce it in the world's media, shout it as loud as you can, that your corporations will voluntarily place themselves at the command of the GEC for the length of this emergency period. You will follow GEC orders to do whatever is necessary to save the planet from the greenhouse cliff, but without relinquishing ownership or control of your companies. Got that? That's the only way to work it. Voluntary cooperation. That's the only way to beat this greenhouse disaster. Cooperate voluntarily with the GEC. Let the bastards take all your profits, but run your companies yourselves. You know how to do that better than any desk-bound paper shuffler." The door to his office burst open and Kate Williams strode in with half her team behind her. "Daniel Hamilton Randolph, you are under arrest for kidnapping," she said. The window wall went dark. 16. Dan grinned at Kate Williams from behind his desk. "Welcome back, Scarlett. You're fired." She almost grinned back at him.
"You can't fire me. I resigned 12 hours ago."
"You never really did work for me anyway, did you?"
"We don't have time for chit-chat," Kate snapped. "You're under arrest. Get on your feet and come with us."
Dan put his hands flat on the desktop. "Now, wait a minute. I'm being charged with kidnapping, right? Well, here's my victim. Let's ask her if she was kidnapped or not."
"Nice try, Dan, but I've already spoken with President Scanwell while we were on the way here. She'll testify that you brought her here against her will."
Dan swiveled his chair slightly to face Jane. "Is that true?" Jane hesitated only a fraction of a heartbeat.
"Yes. That will be my testimony. That's what you did, Dan, and we both know it."
He shrugged as if defeated. "Et tu, Janie?"
"On your feet, Randolph," snapped one of the young men standing beside Kate. He looked like a jock, broad shoulders, burr haircut, jacket straining across his chest.
Dan realized that he was carrying a gun in a shoulder holster. Probably all of them are, except for Kate. Maybe her, too. Be just like her to have a loaded bra. Slowly, so as not to alarm them, Dan slid open the top drawer of his desk. "Just give me a minute here," he muttered, as he pushed away the papers that covered the slim, matte gray pistol he had put there. "I really have no intention of going anywhere with you, Kate," he said, leveling the pistol at them with one hand and pulling out his computer keyboard with the other.
"This is nonsense," Kate began. "You can't—"
But the burr head beside her started to reach into his jacket. Dan fired once, a sudden, shocking explosion of noise and smoke. The kid slammed over backward as if hit by a baseball bat and smashed into the couch along the far wall, then slumped to the floor. Before any of the others could react, Dan said, "He's not hurt much. It's a tranquilizer dart. He'll be okay in a few hours." No one else moved. "I spent a lot of years in Venezuela," Dan said, tapping keys with his left hand. "The Indians out in the Orinoco River Valley have developed some dandy drugs. They use them for hunting. Once in a while, they hunt other people. Still a few cannibals out there, although nobody wants to admit it." He grinned wickedly.
"Dan, you're crazy," Jane said. "You can't expect to get away with this."
He pointed the gun at her. "You're a hostile witness, Madam President. The jury will disregard your remarks."
"He's gone insane," Kate said.
"Maybe." Dan swung the gun back toward her. "Is insanity a valid defense in my case?" She clenched her fists and took a step toward him. "Don't let your temper trip you up, Scarlett. I'll shoot you if you force me to. And I don't know how the stuff in these darts might affect you. The dose is big enough to knock out a horse like your snoozing pal. It might do more damage to somebody of your petite size."
"You're only making things tougher for yourself," Kate said.
But she stood still. "Tougher than a kidnapping charge? Terrorism is punishable by execution. What can be tougher than that?"
Jane said, "Dan, please."
He gave the keyboard one final touch, with a flourish of his left hand, then stood up. A hooting wail clamored out of the speaker set into the ceiling panels.